Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, February 19th, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. Ukraine. Biden says Putin has chosen war. President says result could be catastrophic and needless conflict. By Michael D. Shear, Valerie Hopkins, Mark Santora, and Ivan Necheparenko. Submarine Secrets Plot. Former teacher pleads guilty to helping husband. Written by John Robbie. Climate Models. The fallout of drought. Extended dry period in the West likely to continue, straining vital water supplies. By Conrad Swanson. Fairview High. Former student gets jail in rapes. Written by Elise Schmelzer. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Ukraine. Biden says Putin has chosen war. President says result could be catastrophic and needless conflict. By Michael D. Shear, Valerie Hopkins, Mark Santora, and Ivan Necheparenko. The New York Times. Washington. President Joe Biden said Friday that the United States has intelligence showing that President Vladimir Putin of Russia has made a final decision to reject diplomatic overtures and invade Ukraine in what Biden said would be a catastrophic and needless war of choice in Eastern Europe. Speaking from the Roosevelt Room in the White House, Biden said, "We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days," adding that we believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. Asked whether he thinks that Putin is still wavering about whether to invade, Biden said, "I'm convinced he's made the decision." Later, he added that his impression of Putin's intentions is based on a significant intelligence capability. Still, Biden implored Russia to seek diplomacy. "It is not too late to de-escalate and return to the negotiating table," Biden said, referring to planned talks between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russia's foreign minister Thursday. "If Russia takes military action before that date, it will be clear that they have slammed the door shut on diplomacy." In the hours before Biden's late afternoon remarks, Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine called for mass evacuations in two contested regions of the country, claiming, with little evidence, that Ukraine's military was about to launch a large-scale attack there, an assertion that appeared intended to provoke Russian military intervention. The ominous messaging of the rebels in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk was loudly echoed by Moscow, raising fears that Russia was setting the stage for an imminent invasion that could ignite the biggest conflict in Europe in decades. The call by the Russian-backed separatists for evacuations came as they blamed Ukraine for an array of provocations, including shelling along the front lines between Ukraine and the separatist forces, and an explosion involving an empty car that pro-Moscow news outlets said belonged to the head of the region's security services. Biden, who had just concluded a video call with a dozen Western leaders, rejected the claims as lies intended by Putin to inflame the situation on the ground and provide a pretext for war, something the United States and other European leaders have been warning about for weeks. He cited the bombing of a Ukrainian kindergarten as a Russia-backed provocation, and he pointed to Russian separatist accusations that Ukraine was planning to launch a major offensive attack as evidence of Russian efforts to justify military action with misinformation. "There is simply no evidence to these assertions, and it defies basic logic to believe the Ukrainians would choose this moment, with well over 150,000 troops arrayed on its borders, to escalate a year-long conflict," Biden said. The president's comments are the clearest indications of just how close the world may be to the largest conflict in Europe since World War II. He took the highly unusual course of specifically predicting the time frame and parameters of the invasion, despite the risks that he could be proved wrong. "We're calling out Russia's plans loudly and repeatedly," Biden said, "not because we want a conflict, but because we're doing everything in our power to remove any reason that Russia may give to justify invading Ukraine and prevent them from moving." The president did not say how the administration knew about Putin's decision, but two U.S. officials said the president's assessment was based in part on new intelligence showing that nearly half of the 150,000 Russian forces have moved out of staging and into combat formation and could launch a full-scale invasion within days. The force includes 120 to 125 battalion tactical groups, up from the mid-80s earlier in the month. And some of the forces are Russian reservists who would make up an occupation force after an invasion, the officials said. The officials asked for anonymity to discuss government assessments. The White House blamed Russia on Friday for this week's cyber attacks, targeting Ukraine's defense ministry and major banks, and warned of the potential for more significant disruptions in the days ahead. Ann Neuberger, the Biden administration's deputy national security advisor for cyber and emerging technologies, said the U.S. had rapidly linked Tuesday's attacks to Russian military intelligence. The attacks, which knocked government websites and a couple of major banks offline for much of the day, were of limited impact because Ukrainian officials were able to quickly get their systems back up and running, Neuberger said. Biden vowed that the United States and its allies were united behind imposing severe economic sanctions if Russia's forces cross Ukraine's borders. He said he also held a call with Democratic and Republican lawmakers who expressed united support for the administration during a visit to Munich for a security conference. In Ukraine, the head of the country's Ministry of Defense said the claim of an imminent attack by its military was categorically false and intended to inflame tensions. But the ministry issued a stark warning to residents of the contested regions not to leave their homes and not to use public transport. It cited information that Russian special services have mined a number of social infrastructure facilities in Donetsk with the aim of destabilizing the situation there. The warning reflected how Russia appeared to be pulling out all the stops to pressure the Ukrainians, short of sending its troops across the border. The fears of brewing conflict were reinforced as U.S. officials said that as many as 190,000 troops and aligned militias were arrayed in and near Ukraine, a number that includes the separatists. The assessment was delivered in a statement by the U.S. mission to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which called it the most significant military mobilization in Europe since the Second World War. Consistent with Russia's contradictory messaging throughout the crisis, however, Putin said Friday that he was prepared for further diplomacy. The announcement of the meeting between Blinken and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov calmed jittery markets and suggested that there was still hope for the crisis to be resolved without war. But Putin emphasized that Russia would continue to insist on far-reaching demands for security guarantees in Eastern Europe that the West has rejected, such as a halt to the eastward expansion of NATO and the pullback of the alliance's forces from the region. "We are ready to go on the negotiating track under the condition that all questions will be considered together without being separated from Russia's main proposals," Putin said in a news conference alongside his close ally, President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus, who was visiting Moscow. Friday's drumbeat of alarms from the separatists about Ukrainian provocations aligned with how Western officials have been warning that a false flag incident could be used to start a military conflict. In calling for people in the contested areas to evacuate to Russia, Denis Pushilin, the pro-Moscow leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, offered a stark version of what might be coming in citing supposed provocations by Ukraine. Submarine Secrets Plot: Former Teacher Pleads Guilty to Helping Husband, by John Robbie. The Associated Press. Charleston, West Virginia. A former Denver area teacher pleaded guilty Friday to her role in a plot with her husband to sell submarine secrets to a foreign country. Diana Toby, who now lives in Maryland, entered the plea in federal court in Martinsburg to one count of conspiracy to communicate restricted data. Prosecutors said they would seek a prison term of up to 3 years at sentencing. Her husband, Jonathan, a Navy nuclear engineer, pleaded guilty Monday to passing information about American nuclear-powered warships to someone he thought was a representative of a foreign government, but who was actually an undercover FBI agent. The Tobys worked as teachers in Metro Denver in the mid-2000s. Jonathan Toby taught at Kent Denver, a private prep school in Englewood, from 2005 to 2008. And Diana Toby taught there from 2005 to 2012, according to a school spokeswoman. Diana Toby was charged with acting as a lookout at several prearranged dead drops locations at which memory cards containing the secret information were left behind. At the time of her arrest, Diana Toby was teaching at a private school in Maryland. In pleading guilty to the same charge as his wife, Jonathan Toby, 43, faces a potential punishment from 12 to 17 years in prison, a sentencing range agreed to by lawyers. Prosecutors said he abused his access to top-secret government information and repeatedly sold details about the design elements and performance characteristics of Virginia-class submarines. Jonathan Toby acknowledged during his plea hearing that he conspired with his wife to pass classified information to a foreign government in exchange for money with the intent to injure the United States. The memory cards were devices concealed in objects such as a chewing gum wrapper and a peanut butter sandwich. The Annapolis, Maryland couple was arrested on October 9th after he placed a memory card at a dead drop location in Jefferson County, West Virginia. The FBI has said the scheme began in April 2020 when Jonathan Toby sent a package of Navy documents to a foreign government and wrote that he was interested in selling to that country operations manuals, performance reports, and other sensitive information. He included in the package, which had a Pittsburgh return address, instructions to his supposed contact for how to establish a covert relationship with him, prosecutors said. That package was obtained by the FBI in December through its legal attaché office in the unspecified foreign country. That set off a months-long undercover operation in which an agent posing as a representative of a foreign country made contact with Toby, ultimately paying $100,000 in cryptocurrency in exchange for the information Toby was offering. The country to which Jonathan Toby was looking to sell the information has not been identified in court documents and was not disclosed in court during his wife's plea hearing Friday. Jonathan Toby, who held a top-secret security clearance through the Defense Department, agreed as part of the plea deal to help federal officials with locating and retrieving all classified information in his possession, as well as the approximately $100,000 in cryptocurrency paid to him by the FBI. FBI agents who searched the couple's home found a trash bag of shredded documents, thousands of dollars in cash, valid children's passports, and a go bag containing a USB flash drive and latex gloves, according to court testimony last year. Climate models, the fallout of drought. Extended dry period in the West likely to continue, straining vital water supplies. By Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Not only is the American West the driest it's been in more than a millennia, but the mega drought is likely to continue for years, diminishing Colorado's short water supply and increasing the risk of wildfires, climatologists say. The current 22-year mega drought plaguing the West has surpassed the mega drought in the late 1500s, previously considered the worst on record, according to a study published this week in the scientific journal Nature Climate Change. Plus, about 42% of this mega drought severity can be blamed on climate change caused by humans. Soil moistures, increasing temperatures, and climate modeling shows a 94% chance that the drought will continue for a 23rd year. Jason Smurden, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, said, and there is a 75% chance that the mega drought will continue through its 30th year in 2029, Spurden, also a co-author of the study, said. The study focuses mostly on conditions west of the Continental Divide, Russ Schumacher, director of the Colorado Climate Center, said. But those conditions affect life on the Front Range as well. Snow and rainfall can fluctuate through wet and dry months or years, Schumacher said, and because temperatures are increasing, more moisture than normal is lost because of evaporation. The situation gets very concerning if you have lots of years of dryness, and similarly, the precipitation and snowpack that we do get doesn't go as far as it used to, Schumacher said. The likely continuing dry period comes at a time when the Colorado River, which supplies water to about 35 million people, and reservoirs along the waterway are hitting record low levels, Smurden said. Currently, no part of Colorado is untouched by the water shortage, according to data published Thursday by the National Drought Mitigation Center. The vast majority of the state is considered abnormally dry or in varying stages of moderate or severe drought. About 9% of the state's land is considered in extreme drought, the data shows. In addition, snowpack levels for the majority of the state are below normal levels for this time of the year, according to data published Wednesday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Continuous, above-average snowfall and precipitation is needed well into the spring to recharge the state's parched soils and waterways, experts repeatedly have told the Denver Post. Schumacher said some more snowfall is projected for western Colorado next week, but likely not enough. February and March are key times for building that snow accumulation, he said, and unless there are those really big storms like we had in December, things are certainly not in as good a shape as they were a month ago. The ongoing lack of water moving forward would also mean an increased risk of dying forests, wildfires, insect outbreaks, and other environmental consequences, Murden said. Agriculture, tourism, and other portions of the economy also would suffer, although the societal implications are difficult to predict, he said. We know what happens when we warm the climate, Smurden said. What we don't know is what happens when we warm people. The Nature Climate Change Study, which examined soil moisture and data collected in tree rings, showed that severe megadroughts have occurred throughout the Earth's history, Smurden said. But human development and the outpouring of greenhouse gas emissions worsened the effects of these naturally occurring droughts. This would have been a dry period, absent human influence, but it wouldn't have been as severe, as long, or as uniformly widespread in the Southwest, Smurden said. Unless humans take steps to stop dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the effects of climate change are likely to compound, he said. If you're in a hole, stop digging, Smurden said. We absolutely have to reverse course. Fairview High. Former student gets jail in rapes, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. More than 5 years after a fellow Fairview High School student raped them, two women stood before a Boulder County judge Friday and told him of the horror the rapist inflicted on their lives. The rapist destroyed them, the two women said. They suffered panic attacks and self-harm. They dropped advanced classes, quit extracurricular activities. They struggled to graduate. They lost friendships. He made them hate their bodies. He made them want to die. Do you know what it's like to feel your soul slowly die? One of the women asked the judge. But the women survived, and they did not back down in their pursuit of justice, even as they were the subject of gossip and bullying at school. Even when they alleged, school officials did little to protect them, even as the criminal justice process dragged on for years. On Friday, the rapist was sentenced to 90 days in jail for sexually assaulting three young women while he was a student and lacrosse player at Fairview High. We have done everything in our power to make sure he never hurts anyone again, one of the women said Friday in court. The Denver Post is not naming the convicted former student because he was prosecuted in juvenile court. The Post also does not name victims of sexual assault. The criminal case, resolved Friday, was one of three at the center of a years-long reckoning over how Fairview High School and the entire Boulder Valley School District handle sexual assault allegations. Students began a campaign to reform the district's culture, policies, and training after a series of allegations against students, including Fairview star quarterback. A jury acquitted the quarterback of 5 sex offenses, and he pleaded guilty to 2 counts of harassment, which disappointed several of the women who reported that he had assaulted them. In a separate case, a social worker at the high school was charged with failing to report a student's allegations against the football player to law enforcement. The social worker also was acquitted. The school district also is facing a lawsuit in connection with the criminal case involving the former lacrosse player. The lawsuit, filed in August by 2 of the victims in the criminal case, alleged Fairview High officials knew during the 2016-2017 school year that the lacrosse player was accused of raping at least 2 students but failed to investigate and did nothing to protect students from facing a hostile environment at school. Fairview's principal, Don Stensrud, retired in December after being placed on leave while the school district investigated the allegations in the lawsuit. "You robbed them." At the former lacrosse player's sentencing Friday, the survivors testified how Fairview became hell because school officials failed to remove their assailant from classes, forcing them to encounter their rapist in the hallways. One of the women's mothers said she watched her ambitious, active daughter turn from a lifelong early bird to someone who couldn't get out of bed on some days. The mom spent nights sleeping on the floor next to her daughter's bed, worried her daughter would hurt herself. While other college students are searching online for places to go for spring break, she is searching for where to get trauma-informed treatment, the woman's mother said. Senior visiting Judge Kenneth Plott sentenced the defendant, who was a minor at the time he committed the crimes, to 90 days in the county jail, 2 years of probation, sex offender treatment, and 90 hours of community service. He will also be required to register as a sex offender. The sentence was part of a plea deal in which he pleaded guilty to sexually assaulting the 3 women. Plotts raised concerns about the sentence, which he said seemed light for the seriousness of the charges and their repeated deliberative nature. "You robbed them," Plotts said to the defendant. "You robbed them of the freedom and the wonder and the joy of adolescence." But Boulder Deputy District Attorney Brad Turner said the sentence, agreed to as a part of a plea deal, was discussed with the survivors and had their support. Rejecting the stipulated sentence would force the defendant to withdraw his plea, and the case would continue to drag on, Turner said. "This deal was the product of lengthy discussions with the survivors in this case," Turner said. "This is what they wanted. This is for us all." The defendant apologized to his victims during the sentencing hearing and admitted to his crimes. His defense attorney said he has undergone years of treatment and therapy. "To the women I've hurt, I want you to know my apology is sincere," he said. One of the survivors was 16 when the defendant raped her in a closet at a Halloween party in 2016. He was her boyfriend at the time, her first. He had been her first kiss. She told the judge she could still see the walls of the closet, hear the clamor of the party, feel the grass on the lawn where she sat waiting for a friend's mom to pick her up from the party. "That was the night I lost who I was," she said. Another survivor told the judge that it took her years to be able to say the word rape. The defendant, then a sophomore, raped her in the high school's baseball dugout in May 2017. She was a freshman at the time and had turned 15 a month earlier. She was afraid to report the crime to the school as she had seen how others had been bullied when they spoke up, according to the lawsuit. A third woman, who did not speak in court Friday, was raped by the defendant while at a party in October 2015, according to the lawsuit filed against the school district. The woman's mother reported the rape to Fairview High School officials in late 2016. At least 8 other women have approached the survivors to say they were also assaulted by the defendant, according to the lawsuit. "This is for us all," one of the survivors said Friday during the sentencing. "The survivors are healing," their family said. "They've gone to therapy or spent time away." One of the women's mothers said she's seen the light return to her daughter's eyes. As she finished her statement in court Friday, one of the survivors stood and turned to the man who raped her. She looked him in the eyes in the silent wood-paneled courtroom. "To me, you have been buried forever," she said. "I have set myself free." Proposed initiatives: buy wine at grocery store. Retail group pushes for change, liquor store advocates wary, by Nick Coltrane. The Denver Post. Chris Howes, president of the Colorado Retail Council, envisions a future where Coloradans and visitors can grab a bottle of Chianti at the same time they're picking up pasta to cook for dinner, regardless of their grocery store. Chris Fine, executive director of the Colorado Licensed Beverage Association, worries that the future would come at the expense of mom-and-pop liquor stores that already had their legs cut from under them with recent changes to distribution laws around full-strength beer. Either way, it's a path that may open in Colorado under recently proposed ballot initiatives. The initiatives, submitted Thursday, would allow wine sales at grocery stores and allow wine delivery by third-party services. The initiatives were first reported by the Denver Business Journal. While two initiatives have been filed, Howe said lawmakers will winnow it down to one proposal once lawyers settle on language. The proposals still need to pass procedural review by the state before signatures can be gathered, and voters would have the final say in November. Howe's, whose group represents large grocery and retail chains, said the effort would catch up Colorado with other states' liquor laws and raise the convenience for shoppers by allowing wine sales at grocers and convenience stores licensed to sell beer. There's no reason that Colorado can't modernize its antiquated alcohol laws, Howe said. We think this will be very popular with the voter. Fine, whose group represents liquor stores, called the effort a money grab by out-of-state corporations. I get convenience, Fine said, but I don't get convenience when it comes at the price of shifting profits from small Colorado companies to a large out-of-state organization that doesn't care anything about Colorado. He sees it as a continuation of 2016's beer wars, when a proposed ballot initiative to open up full-strength beer sales to grocery store chains turned into a phased-in compromise bill passed by the legislature. Full-strength beer became widely available at grocers beginning in 2019. Some liquor stores have taken hits of 30% or more of their revenue, Fine said, as consumers grab their suds elsewhere. Losing a chunk of wine sales would cut into that further and likely shutter some shops across the state, he warned. It would also affect a diverse industry, he said. More than two-thirds of his members speak English as a second language and half are women. This will have a dire effect on the small mom-and-pop local liquor store, Fine said. Will some of them survive it? Absolutely. Will some of them not survive it? Yes. Dire predictions from the last time distribution laws changed haven't come to pass, Howe said. Liquor stores are still filling a need in the market, even as people buy full-strength beer at grocery stores. This is instead about convenience and shopper experience, he argued. There's plenty of market, Howe said. We expect that the liquor stores will adapt to the market just like they have in other states. It also isn't a Trojan horse for grocery stores to replace the full offerings of liquor stores, he said. Howe's group has no plans to address spirits such as gin, vodka, and whiskey, he said. Netherlands. Frozen Dead Guy Days returns from deep freeze by Kayleen McCourt. The Daily Camera. After 2 years of pandemic-related cancellations, Frozen Dead Guy Days has been resurrected. The Netherlands-based festival, honoring the town's cryogenically frozen Norwegian resident, Bredo Morstoel, will commence March 18th through the 20th. We are thrilled to return to Netherlands this year to celebrate Grandpa Bredo after a two-year COVID hiatus, said Sarah Mosley Martin, co-owner of Frozen Dead Guy Days. When this pandemic began, FGGD was just days away from start, and as the world shut down, so did we. To be here now, poised for a chance to revel in the magic of a truly unique Colorado cultural event, is such a gift. Festivities kick off March 18th with the Blue Ball that actually falls on a full moon, and organizers have an out-of-this-world offering for attendees. With your ticket purchase of $25, you receive a certified acre on the moon from Lunar Land, said Amanda McDonald, FDGD's co-owner. Festival attire is encouraged from all time, space, and frozen dimensions. At the Blue Ball, folks can look forward to a Grandpa and Ice Queen look-alike contest, a moon dancing competition, and live music from Alfonso, Smooth Money Gesture, and Dead Floyd. The evening will be capped off with a silent disco session until 1 a.m. Live music has always been an integral part of the macabre event that launched in 2002, and this year, organizers have secured an eclectic lineup of more than 30 bands. Participation is what keeps the frozen dead guy days alive, McDonald said. The events are only as awesome as those who take part in them. We've got close to 30 coffin race teams. Their attitude and costumery is what makes it come alive. We have the parade of hearses, frozen t-shirt contests, icy turkey bowling, and more. Not to mention so many bands who have been unable to share their music and energy for so long. Attendees can expect sets from Drunken Hearts, Chain Station, Extra Gold, Green Buddha, Chiro Band, Fox Feather, and many more. It's definitely one of the strangest festivals out there, said Derek Dames-Ole, bassist of Flash Mountain Flood, a band that will perform on March 19th. The lore alone is sure to make your interest peak. This will be our third or fourth FDGD. With FDGD being temporarily paused for the past 2 years, the festival's reemergence is a chance for Frostivarians to show off Frightful Frocks in an even bigger way. The plan is to go all out this year, Ole said. We've played the Blue Ball in the past, and it's pretty incredible how far people will go. From the legendary Polar Plunge to Human Foosball, the amount of ways people can participate in the winter staple is vast. The best part of FDGD are the extra activities, Hull said. My personal fave is probably the coffin races. This year our performance lands on my birthday, so I will be celebrating extra proper. This year's festival will also launch a zero-waste initiative to keep the grounds, town, and nearby reservoir trash-free. The revival of the FDGD is largely the result of funding from the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program. The police, fire, and public works departments have met with FDGD and town monthly since last summer to ensure a safe and manageable event, Martin said. The National and Colorado Independent Venue Associations were also critical in communicating various intricacies of the SVO grant process. We are so grateful for each and every person who took time to help this event back from the deep freeze. In prior years, attendees purchased tickets the day of at the festival. This year, organizers have partnered with Fair Harbor to do pre-event ticket sales for the first time. Single-day music passes are $25. Children ages 12 and under will get in free. The festival's VIP pass is $175, and it includes a ticket to the Blue Ball, entrance to all live music and at all three tents, VIP parking, a swag bag, and more. Of course, much of the event will be different because of COVID. That said, we are committed to being good stewards when mounting this size festival, Martin said. We will be following all state and local COVID protocols. The festival has a fair amount of regulars who are thrilled for its comeback, but it likely will welcome folks outside of Colorado. FDGD is featured in the Colorado Winter Festivals exhibit at Denver International Airport. I'm viewing this year as an icebreaker into the new festival frontier that remains unknown, McDonald said. Hopefully in 2023 we can fully celebrate what I would consider the official 20th annual Frozen Dead Guy Days. Colorado inmates say state is violating ban on forced work. By Colleen Slevin, The Associated Press. Two Colorado inmates who say they were pressured into working despite health concerns are suing the state's prison system, saying it's violating a constitutional ban on slavery and involuntary servitude. In the lawsuit filed Tuesday in Denver, Harold Mortis and Richard Lugaros say they effectively had days added to their sentences when they initially refused to work in 2020 because they lost time credits for not following prison rules. They also were threatened with being placed in isolation for most of the day, with limits on phone calls and family visits, and both resumed work in their prison's kitchen to avoid further sanctions, the lawsuit said. The lawsuit asks that a judge bar the state from forcing inmates to work and to make the case a class action lawsuit, allowing other inmates to join. Colorado Department of Corrections spokesperson Lisa Wiley said the department doesn't comment on pending litigation. According to the lawsuit, Mortis and Lugaros contracted COVID-19 in October 2020 during an outbreak at the Fremont Correctional Facility in Canyon City, but were told they needed to work in the kitchen the following month, despite lingering symptoms, because of a staffing shortage. Mortis, who is 32 and has asthma, feared contracting COVID-19 again, and Logarose, 45, who still experiences COVID-19 side effects, told prison workers that working in the close quarters of the kitchen would aggravate mental health problems, including post-traumatic stress disorder, the lawsuit said. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution ended slavery, but it still allows forced labor for those convicted of crimes. Colorado had similar language in its state constitution, but in 2018, voters backed ending slavery and involuntary servitude under all circumstances. Voters in Nebraska and Utah also have passed initiatives amending their state constitutions to do the same. This month, lawmakers in Vermont backed a similar change to its constitution to make it clear that slavery and indentured servitude are prohibited. Voters will be asked to approve it in November. It's not child neglect if a kid plays outside or walks home from school, proposed law says, by Nick Coltrane, The Denver Post. When Brinley Sheffield was 7 years old, she took a sudden interest in running. Her parents, eager to encourage her interests and exercise, made sure she knew their Castle Rock neighborhood and set her loose. A harmless enough freedom, Mom Krista Sheffield thought, at least until a police officer knocked on her door. Brinley had been home from her run for 10 minutes and was worried someone had followed her. That someone turned out to be a would-be Good Samaritan concerned about an unattended child. They called the police, Krista Sheffield said, giving mother and daughter a momentary panic that they had done something wrong. While the interaction itself was mild, Krista Sheffield said the officer was respectful and understanding. It gave the mother of five pause about what she allows her children to do. She tries to fight that inclination in favor of her best parental judgment, but it lingers nonetheless. We have protection for cases where there truly is neglect and something wrong, Sheffield said. But in cases where parents are responsible and mindful and still afraid, I think that's where we have a problem. A bill to address those concerns is making its way through the legislature. On Friday, it unanimously passed a floor vote in the State House of Representatives for the second time. The bill, titled Reasonable Independence for Children, initially was put forward in 2020, but it fell to the wayside during a COVID-19 stressed session. It will go to the Senate for consideration. If House Bill 1090 becomes law, it would ensure kids and parents have that flexibility to do everyday things, and it tightens the definition of neglect to be more specific, sponsor Representative Kim Ransom, Republican of Littleton, said. In short, it specifies that it is not neglect if a reasonable and prudent parent or guardian finds their child mature enough to, by themselves, walk or bike to school, travel to nearby recreation centers or stores, play outside, stay at a safe home. The number of allegations of either neglect or lack of supervision have been on the rise, even as the number of substantiated allegations are falling, fellow sponsor Representative Mary Young, Democrat of Greeley, said. In Colorado, the divide is stark, Young said, citing 2019 state data. Of 3,854 allegations of lack of supervision, 3,169 were unfounded, or 82% of all the allegations. We are not only putting families through trauma, we are restricting what families feel like they can do. And we're also costing taxpayers money with these unfounded and unsubstantiated allegations, Young said. Young, who was a school psychologist by profession, also advocated for the benefits of play in childhood development. Children tend to play longer, more imaginatively, and more socially when they're left to their own devices without adults hovering over them, she said. Lenore Scanese, a founder of the Tree Range Kids Movement and related nonprofit Let Grow, said the current system for reporting child neglect encourages over-reporting without enough concern for the effect that has on the family being reported. Because we're so caring about children, we've been told to overestimate danger, Scanese said. And the two things that happen then are sometimes very good parents are caught up in investigations, and people at Child Protective Services are absorbed in investigating child abuse that isn't child abuse. Scanese tracked some allegations of child neglect that seemed to her like a stretch. She recently wrote about a case in Georgia concerning a mother who was arrested after letting her 14-year-old babysit her 4-year-old son, who wandered off briefly to play with a friend. Most cases don't end up with the parent facing such severe repercussions, Scanese said, but they're illustrative of why some parents second-guess themselves. While the legislation aims to clear up what is not neglect, it is just as much about sending a cultural message that kids playing outside without direct supervision is okay. Ransom said. It's an aim Sheffield agrees with. Even though it's been years since her daughter's run around the block, she still struck that someone that concerned would call the police before even knocking on the door or otherwise assessing the situation. Most parents are trying to do the best for their kids, Sheffield said. That's not every parent, and I'm glad that we have protections for that. But that climate of tattling on other people, I want that to change and to have a community where we look after each other. State may expand college-level classes for incarcerated people. By Jason Gonzalez, Chalkbead, Colorado. In bringing college classes to more incarcerated people, Colorado officials hope to enlighten students and cultivate significant social benefits. The federal government plans to almost double the number of colleges nationwide, offering incarcerated people the ability to earn a college degree and to enable them to once again qualify for federal Pell Grants to cover tuition and other educational expenses. In Colorado, several institutions have indicated interest in joining, and state officials hope they can offer four-year degrees to students. So far, only Trinidad State College in Southern Colorado has participated in the federal Second Chance Pell Experimental Sites Initiative. Graduate Demetrius Heron, 23, said the program feels more like a first chance at a good education for many. Heron entered the youthful offender system at 17. During his six-year sentence, he said he took numerous classes, eventually taking advantage of the Trinidad State Second Chance Pell Program. He graduated with two associate degrees, one in science and one in the arts. He said the program takes people at their lowest point, and someone says to you, "Hey, here's my hand. Let me help you up." Numerous studies have shown the benefits of prison education, including lowered social costs and recidivism rates. About 90% of incarcerated people will be released from prison, said Melissa Smith, Colorado Department of Corrections Assistant Director of Prison Programs. The program benefits not only students, but also their families and communities, Smith said. The federal program, which began in 2015 under the Obama administration, offers classes from 131 colleges to incarcerated students in 42 states. The federal government plans to add 69 schools, opening up the possibility for more Colorado colleges and universities to participate. The U.S. also will expand federal financial aid eligibility to incarcerated students starting in July 2023. Incarcerated people haven't been eligible for federal aid since 1994, when Congress passed a tough-on-crime bill sponsored by then-Senator Joe Biden. The number of students who were receiving an education in prison dropped off significantly. For decades previously, incarcerated people had access to federal aid. The Second Chance Pell Program gives incarcerated students the ability to gain the necessary skills to thrive once they exit the prison system, Smith said. The program also helps instill in families that education can lead to good job opportunities, she said. Potentially, it can lead to stopping a cycle of imprisonment that plays out among families of color and those who are low income. Heron said he's thankful for the education he received while in the Pueblo Youthful Offender System, a maximum security facility housing people ages 14 to 25 sentenced as adults. The Second Chance program truly provides a chance to better your life, he said. There's a lot of people who were victims of circumstance, he said. They weren't given the belief or confidence that they had all the same opportunities as everyone else. When he entered prison, Heron said he wasn't confident. He was sad and depressed, but education helped him grow in ways he never thought possible. He was a speaker at his graduation ceremony, graduated magna cum laude, and after his release, enrolled at Colorado State University, Pueblo. Chalkbeat Colorado is a nonprofit news organization covering education issues. Guns to Garden Tools. State Group Seeks Change, Healing. By Thomas Peipert, The Associated Press. nearly 3 decades after her 3-year-old son was killed in a drive-by shooting that shattered the silence outside a Denver duplex, Charletta Evans was the one piercing the stillness as she eased some of her pain by hammering the melted barrel of a rifle into a garden tool. The event, held at a Denver church, was part of a program run by the Colorado Springs-based nonprofit Raw Tools, which draws inspiration from the Bible verse, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks." To see one more gun off the street is so comforting. I love the idea of something that could potentially cause harm being turned into a garden tool that's going to be something used for productivity, Evans said while holding a photo of her son, Kason, who was killed just before Christmas in 1995. Raw Tools has disabled more than 1,000 firearms across the country since its inception in 2013, shortly after a gunman killed 20 first graders and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Many of the resulting garden tools are donated to participating churches or sold on the Raw Tools website. The group's executive director, Mike Martin, said 1,000 disabled firearms feels small, considering the nearly 400 million guns in the U.S., but it's a start. It's a little bit by a little bit. We affect change by making change in our own lives and compelling others to do the same, he said, noting that Raw Tools also partners with groups that focus on rehabilitating offenders and reconciling them with their victims. The organization's ultimate goal, he said, is to offer a space for people to transform their trauma from something that brings death to their life to something that brings life. At another recent event at a church in Aurora, which has seen an alarming surge in gun violence, the group held an anonymous gun buyback and disabled 75 firearms, 50 of which were semi-automatic. Raw Tools pays $100 for standard rifles, $200 for handguns and semi-automatic firearms, and $300 for AR-style rifles. Chris Silkwood of Denver donated his semi-automatic rifle plus $500 to Raw Tools after his wife read about the organization and said she wanted him to dispose of the gun for her birthday. Silkwood used to work in Iraq and Afghanistan for a construction company that contracted with the U.S. military. He bought the rifle and a handgun after the military required the company's employees to be armed. About a year after he stopped working in the Middle East, Silkwood said the shooting at Sandy Hook made him think about his own young daughter, just starting school at the time, and why anyone should own a rifle like his and the one used in the massacre. "I couldn't think of a good reason," Silkwood said. "It's designed for one purpose only, and that's to kill people, and usually a lot of people." Silkwood, who said he isn't opposed to all guns, didn't want to sell the rifle out of fear that it would end up in the wrong hands, so it sat unused for about a decade until, with the help of Raw Tools, he turned it into his wife's birthday gift. He said he felt relief and pride at the garden tool he created. The sense of relief came from the fact that that gun was gone now and was never going to be used for anything except essentially for gardening, he said. For Evans, the mission of Raw Tools meshes with her own, which includes speaking publicly about her road to forgiving and even advocating for her son's killers. She said that path began the same night her son died in her arms, when she said she felt a presence and heard a voice asking if she would forgive the killers. She immediately agreed. Evans, who went on to form a gang prevention organization and now runs the Colorado Crime Survivors Network, took the opportunity in 2012 to meet for 8 hours with one of the gunmen, Raymond Johnson, who was serving his time in a Colorado prison. From that point on, she said, she accepted Johnson as her son and started advocating for his release. Johnson, who was 15 at the time of the shooting, completed a reentry program for juveniles convicted as adults and walked out of prison a free man in November. Evans said the other gunman, Paul Littlejohn, is expected to be released soon. For Evans, healing has come in many forms, through her spirituality, forgiveness, and advocacy work, but she said she finds the most peace in telling Kason's story. "As long as I continue to reach out to other people, I keep Kason alive," she said. "And that's my goal. As long as I live, I'm going to keep Kason alive with me by sharing my story of forgiveness and how God is able to heal you." I-70 Corridor. Officials encourage public transit as congestion grows. By Libby Stanford, Summit Daily. As the number of cars driving the Interstate 70 mountain corridor increases year over year, Colorado officials are pushing for more widespread use of public transportation. The I-70 Coalition, a nonprofit representing businesses, towns, and county governments across the I-70 corridor, launched its Break Up With Your Car campaign February 8th. The goal is to get people to rethink their options when traveling from Denver to the mountains. The campaign is largely in response to growing traffic numbers on I-70. About 12.6 million cars traveled through the Eisenhower-Johnson Memorial Tunnels in 2021, according to an I-70 Coalition news release. That's an 11% increase over the 11.3 million drivers in 2020, the lowest year since 2014 because of the pandemic. The busiest year on record was 2018 with 13.4 million. The coalition anticipates more growth as people move to Denver, said Margaret Bowes, director of the nonprofit. Knowing that we will never be able to build enough lanes to accommodate all of those cars, we know we need to move in the direction of getting folks to utilize transit between Denver and the mountains, she said. The campaign released information about transit options to town governments and organizations along the corridor, including the Summit County, Breckenridge, Dillon, Frisco, and Silverthorne governments, as well as Arapaho Basin Ski Area, Copper Mountain Resort, and Vail Resort's own ski areas. The nonprofit also published a comprehensive list of transit options at goi70.com/transit. Another major part of the initiative is ensuring people know how they can get around once they get to their destination. Bo said the list includes information on transit options such as Summit Stage and Breckenridge Free Ride. We need a holistic system, Bo said. If we want to get people up to the mountains without a car, we need to make sure that there are ways for them to get from Frisco to Breckenridge to get to the Quandary Trailhead. In Summit County, officials are working to expand transit options in hopes of easing congestion on highly trafficked roads. The Colorado Department of Transportation awarded the Summit County Open Space and Trails Department a $50,000 grant to support a pilot program for transit to the Quandary Peak Trailhead. The county launched the program last summer with the hope of easing traffic along Colorado 9 during the summer, when Quandary is a popular destination. People were parking on the highway, they were parking on roads in the subdivision, and that was blocking people from getting to their houses that lived in the area, as well as making it difficult for emergency vehicles to safely get in and out of Quandary, said Catherine King, director of the county's Open Space and Trails Department. Last year, the county operated the shuttle from August through October. The county received positive feedback from people living in the area and saw a reduction in parking and traffic issues, King said. The grant will help the county run the program again this summer, shouldering some of the costs for drivers' gas, insurance, and advertising. Traffic has been an issue when it comes to managing trails. Although Summit Stage is able to take people to many trails throughout the county, the Open Space and Trails Department is always looking at ways to reduce congestion, King said. Certainly, the use of public transportation and shuttle systems is one tool in the toolbox that we may be looking to in the future to try to better manage crowding at trailheads, she said. Bo said she's continuing to encourage municipalities and businesses to expand their transit options. For example, Copper, A Basin, and Steamboat Resort all have shuttles from Denver to the resort areas. Bo said she would like to see other resorts open transit options as well. Ultimately, reduced congestion along the I-70 corridor will improve business, the environment, and the experience of hundreds of drivers, Bowes said. We don't want skiing in Colorado to be synonymous with traffic, she said. News briefs. Voting law leads to jump in application rejections. Thousands of Texans have had their absentee ballot applications denied as a result of regulations put in place under the state's new election law, a jump in rejections that could force many older and disabled voters to vote in person or not at all in primary elections early next month. With a Friday deadline, election officials in the state's most populous counties have rejected 10% or 12,000 of the absentee ballot applications received as of Thursday, according to voting data obtained by the New York Times. Officials said the rejection rate reflected a significant increase from past years, and most often because a voter failed to satisfy the new identification requirements. As they prepare for the March 1st primary, election officials say the new law is sowing confusion among voters and burdening local election offices. The new law, a key Republican priority, added a host of new restrictions to voting in the state, including banning drive-through voting and 24-hour voting, limiting drop boxes, adding new identification requirements to absentee ballots, and preventing local election officials from promoting absentee voting. Police arrested scores of demonstrators and towed vehicles Friday in Canada's besieged capital, Ottawa, and a stream of trucks started leaving under the pressure, raising authorities' hopes for an end to the three-week protest against the country's COVID-19 restrictions. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, February 19th, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.